I've titled the sermon Babylon the Great. But before I go into Babylon the Great, I'd like to ask you a few questions. You've all heard about, I suppose, because we just ran an article in our latest Q&A, Daniel 4, the dream which Nebuchadnezzar had in Daniel 4. The question I'd like to ask, does this dream have any prophetic hidden meaning for us today? Again, let me ask you for a show of hands. How many of you have heard in your life about the concept, not that you agree or disagree with it, just have you heard about the concept that the dream of Daniel 4, where Nebuchadnezzar sees a tree being chopped down but still having roots intact, that has prophetic meaning for us today? How many of you have heard that? Oh, quite a few. Quite a few. I've heard it too. When I came into the church, I've heard it too. But then that idea kind of died out for important reasons and was forgotten, was never really talked about anymore for a long time until recently somebody asked me a question about it, which then prompted me to go on the internet and do some research to see what is being said. And to my great amazement, I found that this idea is still alive to a certain extent, with some twists. Obviously, those twists were important because the original concept was clearly wrong. But there were some twists. But in looking at the twists, I decided to address this issue some more, lest any of us get confused about it. Let me ask a second question. Does Daniel 4 tell us that the ancient Babylonian Empire was imprisoned or chained or paralyzed since its fall in 539 BC, and that it would come back to power 2,520 years later in 1982 AD? Does that dream in Daniel 4 tell us that, as some say it does? We'll go into this to see what the rationale for that concept is and what the Bible has to say about it. In order to do that, I'd like to go with you to Daniel chapter 4 and let's just read that scripture. Let's just read Daniel chapter 4 and let's just read what is said about this very interesting dream. Daniel chapter 4. And I'd like to start reading beginning in verse 4. Of Daniel chapter 4, because here is the one who had the dream, and he is telling us about it. Daniel 4:4. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in my house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts on my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. Therefore I issued a decree to bring in all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of that dream. And then the magicians and the astrologers and the Chaldeans and the soothsayers came in, and I told them the dream, but they did not make known to me its interpretation. But at last Daniel came before me, his name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. In him is the spirit of the holy God. And I told the dream before him, saying, Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy God is in you and no secret troubles you, explain to me the visions of my dream that I have seen and its interpretation. So notice carefully, Nebuchadnezzar is asking Daniel to tell him the meaning of that dream. Let's see what Daniel is saying. First of all, let's listen to the dream. Verse 10. And these were the visions of my head while I was on my bed. I was looking, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong. Its height reached to the heavens, and it could be seen to the ends of all the earth. Its leaves were lovely, its fruit abundant, and it was good for all, and it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, the birds of the heavens dwelt in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. And I saw in the visions of my head while on my bed, and there was a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven, apparently an angel. He cried aloud and said thus, chop down the tree and cut off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruits. Let the beasts get out from under it and the birds from its branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze, in the tender grass of the field. Let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts on the grass of the earth. Let his heart, now this shows already that we're not just talking about an ordinary tree here, let his heart be changed from that of a man, let him be given the heart of a beast, and let seven times pass over him. This decision is a decree of the watchers and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of man, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, declare its interpretation. Since all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the Spirit of the Holy God is in you. So far the dream. Now comes the interpretation. I'd like to say here that Nebuchadnezzar had another dream, which is shown in Daniel chapter 2, where Daniel also gives him the interpretation, makes it very clear that dream in Daniel 2 referred to not just Nebuchadnezzar, but to four kingdoms, the fourth of which would exist until the return of Christ. Now let's see whether Daniel is saying anything in particular which is remotely similar to the dream in Daniel chapter 2. All right, let's keep going. Verse 19. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for a time, and his thoughts troubled him. So the king spoke and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. And Belteshazzar, Daniel, answered and said, my lord, may the dream concern those who hate you, and its interpretation concern your enemies. The tree that you saw, which grew and became strong, whose height reached to the heavens, and which could be seen by all the earth, whose leaves were lovely and its fruit abundant, in which was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and in whose branches the birds of the heaven had their home, it is you, O king, who have grown and become strong, for your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens, and your dominion to the end of the earth. And inasmuch as the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave its stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts of the field till seven times pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lords the king, they shall drive you from all men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over you, till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. And inasmuch as they gave the command to leave the stump and roots of the tree, your kingdom shall be assured to you after you come to know that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, let my advice be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by being righteous, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity. Is there any remote indication in this interpretation that this dream could apply to anybody and anything else but Nebuchadnezzar? Nothing in that interpretation. Now, I will show you how some have concluded it does, but they can't do it based on what's written here in the Bible. Because I'm not done yet, because let's keep reading. Because now, see what happens, beginning in verse 28. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of the 12 months, he was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. And the king spoke, saying, Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? And while the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken. The kingdom has departed from you, and they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. That very hour the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. And at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes into heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion, his kingdom is from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven, and among the inhabitants of the earth no one can restrain his hand or say to him, What have you done? And at the same time my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me, and I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. And now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth, and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride, he is able to put down. Still nothing. Even as much as suggesting that this dream goes beyond the person of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, before I go into this concept, let us quickly go through some of those scriptures and explain exactly what is being stated here. In verse 14 of Daniel 4, we read about the cut down tree. It says, cut down the tree and cut off its branches. Now, I went through lots of commentaries to see what they got to say about these things. Here's one by Adam Clark's commentary. He points out, rightly so, that this verse tells us that the tree was to be cut down and that the beasts were commanded to flee away from under its branches. This means that the king's officers, etc., all abandoned him as soon as his insanity appeared, and he soon fled from the society of men. In verse 15, we read about that the stump and the roots would remain. Now again, let's listen to what Albert Barnes had to say about that concept. The word here used for stump implies that it was still alive, or that there was a germ which would send up a new shoot so that the tree would live again. The idea is that though the mighty tree would fall, yet there would remain vitality in the root, or the portion that would remain in the earth after the tree was cut down, and that this would spring up again. A most striking image of what would occur to Nebuchadnezzar after he should be cast down from his lofty throne, and he again was restored to his reason and to power. Now what about verse 15, which talks about, nevertheless leaves the stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze. What is that iron and bronze bass or band all about? Let's not start having all kinds of wild speculations as to what it might be about. Let's stick to what the Bible has to say about it, and the way it's being explained, and correctly so, by several commentators. John Gill is talking about the fact that the allusion is to his Nebuchadnezzar's, because the dream talks about Nebuchadnezzar. His distracted condition afterwards related, it being usual to bind madmen with chains of iron or brass to keep them from hurting themselves and others. And you find a parallel scripture in Mark chapter 5 and verse 4, where a demon-possessed person had to be chained that way so that he wouldn't hurt himself and others. The commentary of Barnes goes even a little bit further and gives another possible explanation. It says this expression may be regarded as applicable either to the cut down tree or to the humbled monarch. If applied to the cut down tree, it would seem that the idea is that the stump or root of a tree deemed so valuable would be carefully secured by an enclosure of iron or brass, either in the form of a hoop placed around the top of the stump to preserve it from being opened or cracked by the heat of the sun so as to admit moisture which would rot it, or around the roots to bind it together with the hope that it would grow again. Or it may refer to a railing or enclosure of iron or brass to keep it from being plowed or dug up as worthless. In either case, it would be guarded with the hope that a tree so valuable might spring up again. If applied to the monarch, it would seem to refer to some method of securing the royal maniac in bonds of iron and brass, as with the hope that the reason might still be restored, or with a view to keep him from inflicting fatal injury on himself. That the thing here referred to might be practiced in regard to a valuable tree cut down or broken down is by no means improbable. That it might be practiced in reference to the monarch is in accordance with the manner in which the insane have been treated in all ages and countries. Now remember, this was done to the tree which symbolized Nebuchadnezzar. That's why the band of iron and brass have to have reference to them. I mean to him, to Nebuchadnezzar, to the tree. We also read in verse 16 that this would be happening for seven times. It says the heart of the man would be taken away from him. He would be given the heart of a beast and let seven times pass over him. Now, it says seven times. Most commentaries and others feel strongly that they talk about here 7 years. In many cases, the word times referred to years. I'd just like to quote to you from a commentary again by Barnes saying, the more common interpretation is what supposes that it was a year, and this will agree better with all the circumstances of the case than any other period. Josephus understands by it 7 years. While the Chaldee word is indeterminate in respect to the length of time, the most natural and obvious construction here and elsewhere in the use of the word is to refer to it as years. Days or weeks would be obviously too short, and though in this place the word months would perhaps embrace all that would be necessary, yet in the other places where the word occurs in Daniel, it undoubtedly refers to years, and there is therefore a propriety in understanding it in the same manner here. And then we, in this update here, quote several other sources: Treasury of Scriptural Knowledge, Commentary of Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, Commentary of Adam Clark, Commentary of Jill. They all understand this to refer to years, not months or days. We also have read that after those 7 years, the king would be restored, his sanity would be returned, and historically, no new king was set up while Nebuchadnezzar was insane. His son, evil Merodach, was the regent during his father's insanity, but he again turned over the empire to his father when his father became sane again. Now, again, we don't know that we can say it dogmatically, but the assumption has always been that God took away the spirit in man from Nebuchadnezzar during those 7 years and gave him the spirit of an animal. And then after those 7 years, he again gave him back the spirit of man, which, of course, distinguishes men from animals. Now, verse 34 of this particular passage talks about at the end of the time. And some have looked at this and have said, oh, this means end time. So here, clearly, it shows that this is a prophecy for the end time. But look what it says. It says, at the end of the time, which time? The time which was allotted to Nebuchadnezzar's insanity. At the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven. So it's still talking about what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. So it is the time when he was restored back to sanity. As Barnes explains it, that is the time designated. That is the seven times that were to pass over him. Jill adds that of the time fixed in the dream, that is, at the end of the 7 years. Now, so far, the dream, and so far, the obvious interpretation. Now let's talk about those who claim that it has prophetic meaning for us today. Because they have pointed out that those 7 times, or those 7 years, as we read about, the 7 years, now listen carefully, the 7 years of insanity, because Nebuchadnezzar was insane for those 7 years, that these are 7 prophetic years of punishment for the entire Babylonian Empire. And so they have said a prophetic year of 360 days is equivalent to 360 years. And in applying the principle of one day for 1 year and vice versa, you get 2,520 days, or a day equals a year, 2,520 years. Now, it is true that in the Bible you sometimes have this principle. You find it in Numbers chapter 14 and in verse 34. You also find it in Ezekiel chapter 4, verses 4 to 6. So, in applying this, they said, okay, now here we have it. We start counting from the fall of Babylon, which happened in 539 B.C., and you add 2,520 years to the fall of Babylon, gets you to 1982 A.D., and that's the year where the insanity, the paralysis, the curse, the punishment of the Babylonian Empire stopped, was removed, and now the Babylonian Empire would come back to power in 1982. That's the rationale. That's, to my big astonishment, something which is still being taught by some in certain circles. So again, let's make clear you understand what the rationale is. The rationale is that the Babylonian Empire was somehow unproductive for 2,520 years after its ancient fall, but emerged again in 1982. It's further said that the Catholic Church began in 1982 to exert its ever-growing influence on the countries of Europe, and that the countries of Europe experienced a revival beginning in 1982. And they say, okay, this is the time after those 7 years when this band of iron and bronze, which was bound around the tree, was loosed. And so now we get 1982, when the confinement, so to speak, of Babylon was no longer in force and effect. Now let me ask you. I wouldn't even bring it up if it wouldn't be. And you go to the internet and you do some search on that, and you'll be surprised how many are teaching this in one way or another. So let's address it. Is that even biblically possible? I mean, it's clearly speculative. Obviously, the interpretation of the dream here doesn't say anything about the kind, but is it even biblically possible that Babylon was restrained for 2,520 years and that it came back to power in 1982? Let's think of Babylon a moment. In a few seconds, we'll go into the biblical definition of who Babylon actually is today. I think we all know. We are reaching a point of a great tribulation, which is so bad that unless Jesus Christ would intervene, no human flesh would be saved alive. This great tribulation is caused to a large extent by a United States of Europe, which is forming in front of our eyes right now. So if we were to apply the concept, as we read about here in the book of Daniel, of 7, let's even say prophetic years, of insanity to Babylon, what would this mean? It would mean that in 1982, Babylon came back to sanity. Babylon repented of its pride, because that's what Nebuchadnezzar did after the 7 years of insanity. Did we see that Europe repented of its pride in 1982? Did we see that Europe came back to sanity in 1982? In fact, what we see is the absolute opposite. What we are seeing is that Babylon is becoming more and more insane and being largely responsible, as I said, for bringing about the Great Tribulation with the potential of destroying all mankind. Not even a remote suggestion that Babylon repented of its pride and regained its sanity in 1982. What is so particular and special about 1982 to begin with? Let's talk about those who claim that in 1982, Babylon started to come back to power. So what happened in 1982? You would assume something really dramatic happened in 1982. Well, the only thing which happened in 1982 is a speech which Pope John Paul II gave, stating that Europe should discover its origins and give life to its roots. Oh, well, clear. I mean, obviously, now he's talking about the tree which was cut down, right? And so now it's being given life to its roots. That's the only thing they could come up with, which happened in 1982. We'll see in a moment that there are years which actually do have some interesting relevance for the revival of the last resurrection, so to speak, of the Roman Empire, but it wasn't 1982. In order to understand why this prophecy here, Daniel 4, cannot possibly refer to anybody and anything but Nebuchadnezzar, and most certainly not to a modern Babylon coming back to power in 1982, let's talk about who, according to the Bible, Babylon is, modern Babylon. Let's not talk about human interpretation. The Bible tells us that no prophecy should be the product of human interpretation or speculation. Let's turn with me, please, to Revelation chapter 17, and let's talk about the biblical definition of Babylon as it will exist in these end times, but as it has already existed for quite a while. Revelation 17, beginning in verse 1, because here's another vision. John, the Apostle John, sees something in a vision. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot, who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names and blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication, and on her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth." So who is Babylon? The woman riding the beast. Let's look at a few more passages to see how this woman is further described. Verse 6, "I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I marveled with great amazement." Let's look at verse 9. "Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads." Remember now, the woman is riding a beast with seven heads. The seven heads are seven mountains, or as other translations have it, like the NIV, Living Bible, and others, seven hills on which the woman sits. To make it very clear what kind of woman we are talking about, let's go with me to verse 18. "And the woman whom you saw is that great city, which reigns over the kings
of the earth.
So now, which religious city, because the woman clearly is here referred to as some kind of a religious power, which religious city is built on seven hills and which rules over the kings of the earth in one way or another? Remember now, the woman sits on the beast with seven heads. Now, there's another beast described in Revelation 13, actually also in Daniel 7. That beast is referred to there as the Roman Empire. Now, I want to quickly go back and give you the background. In Daniel chapter 2 and in other places in the book of Daniel, Daniel sees all kinds of visions. And by the way, we have a booklet out there entitled Europe and Prophecy. And in the middle of the booklet, we have a chart. And this chart explains exactly all the prophecies in the book of Daniel, Daniel 2, Daniel 7, Daniel 8, Revelation 13, Revelation 17. And it shows how they all go together. And so in Daniel 2, of course, you have a statue which Nebuchadnezzar sees. Head of gold. It has arms of silver. It has a chest of brass. It has also feet and legs of iron, and it has 10 toes, mixed of iron and clay. And then you find that a stone from nowhere is smashing the image on the toes and replaces it by restoring a kingdom which would be of worldwide proportions. And it's very clear that this is talking about four successive kingdoms. The kingdom under Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian kingdom, followed by the Medo-Persian kingdom, followed by the kingdom of Alexander the Great and his four generals, followed by the Roman kingdom, the Roman Empire. And then the Roman Empire, it was described in other places in the book of Daniel, chapter 7, and also in Revelation 13, would have 10 horns, signifying 10 revivals or 10 resurrections of the Roman Empire. All right? Now, when you look at the beast in Revelation 13, you find that what John is seeing here is a beast composed of elements of a lion, of a leopard, of a bear. It has 7 heads. The one head of the Babylonian Empire, depicted also in Daniel as a lion. The one head of the Medo-Persian Empire, depicted by Daniel as a bear. The 4 heads of the Greco-Macedonian Empire, because when Alexander died, and he is depicted as a leopard with 4 heads, when he died, his 4 generals took over. And then you have the 4th empire, the Roman Empire, which had 10 horns. And all of this put together in the book of Revelation in chapter 13. So what John is seeing now in that particular place is no longer Babylon. That's gone. But he's seeing the Roman Empire, which had absorbed all the characteristics of Babylon and Greece and Medo-Persia. And it was that Roman Empire which would be resurrected 10 times. You see, that is what is being prophesied in Scripture. And as I will show you in a moment, 9 of those 10 resurrections have already occurred. The 10th is occurring right now. But when you go back to Revelation 17, where the woman rides the beast, there that beast has 7 heads, signifying the last 7 of the 10 revivals of the Roman Empire. You see, the woman didn't sit on the first 3. The first 3 revivals were revivals by barbarian hordes, as history books call them. These were tribes like the Vandals, the Heruli, or the Ostrogoths. They didn't believe in the religion of that woman. In fact, Daniel tells us that the woman would be responsible for destroying those 3 empires. So the first 3 of the 10 revivals of the Roman Empire were those the woman had nothing to do with. But beginning with the 4th revival, and all the way through until the final one, the woman would be sitting on those resurrections. Now, what occurred historically? Justinian united East and West Rome. This is called in history books the Imperial Restoration of Europe. After that, Charlemagne was crowned as the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire in 800 AD in the German city of Aachen by Pope Leo III. After that, Otto the Great was crowned by Pope John the XII, and he was crowned as the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation. Then you had another revival under Charles V of Habsburg. He was crowned by Pope Clement VIII. Then you had a revival under Napoleon Bonaparte. He was crowned by Pope Pius XII. And the six of the last seven revivals took place under Hitler and Mussolini. Now, they weren't crowned by a pope, but they worked very closely together with the pope, with Pope Pius XII. Now, why is this important in relationship to what we're talking about here? Well, simply because it shows that Babylon, the woman riding the beast, has been riding the beast since Justinian. Not since 1982, but since Justinian. Showing that the whole concept that Babylon was paralyzed for 2,520 years until 1982 is just not in accordance with history. Now, that woman existed long before 2,522 years after the fall of Babylon. For instance, let me quote to you from Will Durant. He wrote in The Story of Civilization that the code of Justinian, or the one who brought about the forced resurrection of the Roman Empire, the code of Justinian, quote, enacted Orthodox Christianity into law and acknowledged ecclesiastical leadership of the Roman Church and ordered all Christian groups to submit to her authority. Close quote. And those who wouldn't do would be killed. That was under Justinian. Even if we look at more modern times, let's look at 1929. Now, mind you, according to this theory that Babylon was paralyzed, Babylon was still paralyzed at that time. Didn't even play any role in 1929. But look what happened in 1929. In 1929, the Lateran treaties were signed between Mussolini and the Pope, establishing the Vatican City. That didn't even exist before as a city. But not only that, now this is according to even Catholic papers. It established the international character of the Holy See, and notice, it made Catholicism the official religion of Italy, which it still is today. 1929. Why wasn't that an important date? Well, because it wouldn't fit in the seven prophetic years idea. What about 1933? Because that was the year when Adolf Hitler signed a concordat with the Vatican. 4 years later, purportedly protecting the rights of the Catholic Church in Nazi Germany. Now, the German paper Der Stern wrote the following about this particular treaty and also the previous treaty under Mussolini in 2004. It said that Mussolini's and Hitler's fascist governments profited from the Lateran treaties and the concordat, and that the Catholic Church supported the fascist propaganda. Now, again, I know that today the Catholic Church is trying very hard to tell us that the Pope at the time was really very much instrumental in protecting the Jews and had nothing to do with Nazi Germany and nothing to do with Mussolini. Well, the facts of history just do not correspond with that at all. It's very well known that the Catholic Church had a lot to do with what Hitler and Mussolini did. But now, let me just pause here a little bit and talk a little bit about Hitler and Mussolini. The ninth resurrection of the Roman Empire. The tenth one is happening right now as we speak, showing also that the time is short, even though it has taken a while to get there. But now it's fully exploding on the world scene. Did you know that Mussolini declared himself as the emperor of the Roman Empire? He knew that he was resurrecting the ancient Roman Empire, as all the other leaders I mentioned, Charlemagne, Charles V, Otto the Great, knew. I mean, otherwise they wouldn't have called themselves emperor of the Roman Empire, of the German nation, and they said Holy Roman Empire because they understood the role of the church, the Catholic Church, in the matter. But what about the fact that Mussolini was also worshipped, literally worshipped by Italians as a god, which he was? And this had a lot to do with the fact that the Roman Caesars, the Roman emperors, declared themselves to be a god and gods and were worshipped by the people of Rome. What about the fact that Adolf Hitler tried to establish a 1,000-year Reich, a millennium? He clearly understood in his own mind, in his weird, twisted mind, that he was used by the way he called it, by some kind of a fate to bring about something spectacular. He had a vision when he was 17 years old, where he saw himself as one who would restore Germany, making it tremendously great and big and building all kinds of powerful buildings. He thought, when people tried to kill him and they were not able to, that he was specifically protected. He was called a savior of Germany, and he himself believed it to be. Now, when he used the famous Hitler greeting, you know, you all remember that, Heil Hitler. This was totally adopted by the way the Romans greeted their emperors. They said, Heil Caesar. Even the way they stretched out their hand is exactly the same way the Romans did it. All of this is clearly showing that they knew what they were doing. Now, whether they knew it or whether they were inspired or led to do it, either way. When, after the ninth resurrection fell apart, people started to work on the tenth and last resurrection of the Roman Empire. And they did it when they started the common market. In fact, when they started a particular treaty. It is called the Treaty of Rome. This was actually done in 1957. That Treaty of Rome was signed by six original member states, Germany being one of them. France was another one, I believe. Italy was one. England was one. I believe Belgium, and maybe I missed one. These six original member states signed the Treaty of Rome. They knew that they were resurrecting the Roman Empire. That was their plan. That's what they were saying. They were doing. But what about Babylon? How did Babylon, that woman riding the beast, how did she get involved in that? Let's just talk about the last resurrection, which we are seeing right now. Now, let us emphasize that the common market itself was started under the inspiration of Catholic politicians. The Telegraph wrote in 1991... that politicians, quote, such as Adenauer of Germany, Paul Henry Spaak, Jean Monnet, and Robert Schuman, were all deeply influenced by Catholic social teaching. The Financial Times added on May 22, 1995, quote, the idea of a united Europe has to be viewed as essentially a Catholic concept. The point is, that Catholic concept existed long before 1982. In fact, 1982 has no bearing whatsoever on the development of the unification of Europe. Yes, the Pope gave a speech. He gave other speeches before and after. The speech didn't do anything. The concept of recreating a United States of Europe existed long before the Pope ever gave that speech. As I said, it was in 1957. That the Treaty of Rome was signed by the original six member states. This is what magazines tell you about this particular incident. Der Stern Online wrote that this treaty signalized the beginning of the success story of Europe. Others talk about that this treaty gave birth to the unification of Europe, which it did. Because without that treaty, we couldn't have a situation now in Europe as we have it. As I said, 1982 was not a decisive year in the development of the last revival of the ancient Roman Empire at all. But I want to give you a few dates now which show that these would be dates. I mean, if you want to look at dates, right, if you want to look at years which are decisive, then let's look at those years, because they did represent milestones in a slow but sure unification of modern Europe. First of all, the Treaty of Rome in 1957. But it just so happened that this morning I found an article which was published today by Deutsche Welle. Let me read it to you. European leaders have assembled in the Hungarian capital Budapest to mark the 20th anniversary of the symbolic fall of the Iron Curtain that divided the continent during the four tenth decades of the Cold War. Heads of state and government of over a dozen European nations, including Germany, Austria, Finland, Slovenia, Switzerland, as well as top officials from Poland and Britain, were among dignitaries from more than 20 countries joining a commemorative session at the Hungarian Parliament. On June 27, 1989, exactly two decades ago, then Hungarian Foreign Minister Gyula Horn and his Austrian counterpart Alois Mock symbolically cut some barbed wire representing the Iron Curtain on the border separating the two countries. 2 months later, on August 19, some 600 East Germans escaped to the West during a picnic for peace organized by the Austro-Hungarian border during a period when the border gate opened for 3 hours. In reality, Hungary had already begun to dismantle the Iron Curtain nearly 2 months earlier, on May 2, 1989. By the end of that summer, thousands of East Germans were camping in tents on the grounds of the West German embassy in Budapest and in several other parts of the city. Most of the refugees made their way to West Germany by September that year. In other words, what we're seeing here is the fall of the Iron Curtain. A tremendously significant and important and decisive event. It didn't take place in 1982. It took place in 1989. But also some other things happened in 1989. Now think about that. Do you know when the Berlin Wall fell? Well, I already gave it to you right now. 1989. November 9, 1989, the Berlin Wall fell. Of course, to have a united Europe under united German leadership needed a united Germany. Germany united the next year, October 3, 1990. Germany, East and West Germany, officially united. Now, if you want to look at dates, these are significant dates, not the date of 1982, which actually did nothing to bring about, per se, a revival of the Roman Empire. But there is another decisive date, very important one. And if you think in terms of the Berlin Wall fell 20 years ago, you can hardly believe it. I still remember sitting in my office when I got a call from Germany, an attorney I was working with over there. He said, "History is being made right now as we speak. The Berlin Wall is falling." 20 years ago. 10 years ago, something else happened. January 1, 1999. The euro was introduced. Now again, 10 years ago, the euro was introduced. Before that, there was no euro. As I said in my Standing Watch program yesterday, it's hard to imagine a world without the euro. I mean, the euro right now is almost already the most powerful currency in the world, and it's destined to become the most powerful currency in the world, replacing the dollar. But in 1999, or let's say in 1998, there was no euro. And I remember when the euro was introduced, how all people complained because they said, "Oh, this is going to be nonsense, and the euro will do nothing." And specifically, the Germans didn't like it because they had to exchange the Deutschmark for the euro and didn't get as much as the Deutschmark was worth. But others already saw that this was a decisive, absolutely critically decisive moment. Newsweek wrote on January 1, 1999, "The euro will turn Europe into a superpower. Whether you love the euro or hate it, Know this, nothing so big has ever happened before. Now, let me remember or remind you that it is the woman, Babylon the Great, which has been sitting on all of the seven last revivals of the Roman Empire. By no stretch of the imagination can it be said then that Babylon had no influence on the world scene and that it was kept in chains for 2,520 years since its fall in 539 BC. It totally flies in the face of everything we have been reading and everything which actually did occur. The dream in Daniel 4 is strictly a dream pertaining to Nebuchadnezzar, his insanity, his revival and restoration, and nothing, absolutely nothing further should be attached to that dream. But it still has a very important message. And the message is that God controls world affairs. Now, he lets Satan many times rule, but he is still in overall control and charge. And he directs sometimes who should rule and will see to it that those will rule. We know that the last leader of the Roman Empire is going to be a very interesting person. He's called the Beast in the book of Revelation. He is called the King of the North in other places. He's actually called King Jareb of Assyria in other places, giving you an idea as to where this individual will come from what particular heritage, from what particular country or ancestry, if you know who Syria is today. Let me briefly mention what happened last week, because, as I mentioned in the announcements, Der Spiegel Online, for instance, wrote that last week the most important decision taken in Europe this year took place. That decision, according to this magazine, could bring about the adoption of the Lisbon Treaty by the end of this year, giving European institutions greater powers, a more permanent EU president, and a more permanent EU foreign minister, and a strengthened role of the EU Parliament. What they did was to make concessions to Ireland, because, as you know, Ireland, up until now, had barked at the concept of adopting the Lisbon Treaty. And now they all said, okay, well, you have special concessions now, so make sure that your people are going to adopt the Lisbon Treaty, and all prognostications are they will. And then you only have two left, that's Germany and that's Czechoslovakia. They have not formally ratified the treaty yet, Germany because of some legal hanglings over there. But nobody, I mean, no serious observer expects Germany and Czechoslovakia to not ratify it. So it's a given. Once Ireland, and they have a referendum coming up very soon, adopts it, it's going to be adopted, and it's going to be law by the end of the year. For the first time, with a powerful EU president. The first time, a powerful EU foreign minister who will speak for Europe with one voice. One of the problems is that so far, Europe has had so many different voices. But let's go on. Let's assume the Lisbon Treaty comes into force and effect. Now, that's not the end of the ball game either. Because the Bible tells us, going back to Revelation 17, that there are going to be 10 kings, 10 nations, or groups of nations, which will give their power and their authority to the beast. Notice Revelation 17 and verse 12. Because remember, the woman was sitting on a beast with 7 heads and 10 horns. What are those 10 horns? In this particular prophecy in Revelation 17, it says, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings which have not received kingdom as yet. So these are 10 kings which would rule or which would live contemporaneously at the very end. It's actually those 10 kings, as we read, who will fight against the returning Jesus Christ. It says they have not received kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour, very short time, perhaps 3.5 years, as kings with the beasts. Verse 13, and these are of one mind. and they will give their power and authority to the beast. Now, this hasn't happened yet. That's not even happening yet, even if the Lisbon Treaty becomes effective, because then you have 27 member states, not 10 nations or groups of nations. So what we can expect to happen is that somehow a kind of core Europe will develop, consisting of the 10 most powerful nations or groups of nations within the greater and bigger framework of a united Europe. And he will be then the one, he meaning the beast, the one who is going to lead the European countries, who will receive all power, unrestrained power, it seems, from those 10 most powerful nations. Now, the interesting thing is, and we pointed this out in our latest update on the current events, that there is great speculation as to who the next EU president might be. And people have talked about Tony Blair, perhaps, as one candidate. People even have talked about Angela Merkel, perhaps, as one candidate, if she should not be reelected as a German chancellor. But all the signs seem to indicate she is going to be reelected as a German chancellor, and the German elections are in September, October. So, therefore, she is not going to be the one. But even if it's Tony Blair or anybody else, that doesn't mean he is the one who is actually finally leading Europe as the one who is receiving the power and authority from the 10 kings or kingdoms, because there is strong indication in some prophecies in the book of Daniel, in the 11th chapter, that a person will become ultimately the leader of Europe who is supplanting the leader at the time. He is referred to as a vile person, and I quote, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he will be gaining authority by intrigue. Now, politically speaking, we have had incidents like that before, where somebody is being elected as a president, let's say, and then, for whatever reasons, that person is not going to stay in power. He might be killed, he might resign, and somebody else comes in place, instead of him. Indications are that that is going to happen with this next and final leader, because it goes on to say in the book of Daniel, in chapter 11, in verse 23, and also in verse 32, that once he is in power, he will act deceitfully, and he will corrupt those with flattery who act wickedly against the covenant. Now, this particular scripture foremost talks about a person in history with the name of Antiochus Epiphanes, who actually did exactly do that. He came into power through flattery. He was a vile person. He acted with intrigue. But you see, here we have an interesting situation. Not the dream in Daniel 4, which has absolutely no dual prophecy fulfillment whatsoever. But here we have one, because Daniel is telling us this. And Jesus Christ is telling us this. Because Jesus Christ is saying, when you see the abomination of desolation, which Daniel speaks about, raised at a place where it shouldn't be, then you know the end of Jerusalem has come near, and that is the time of the great tribulation. And who was the one who brought about the abomination of desolation, the original one? Antiochus Epiphanes. So here you have a potential parallelism between something which is written about Antiochus Epiphanes and the things he did, and something which the final leader of Europe might do. And then you might even have a character description of that final leader, if it matches in some way what's written in Daniel 11 about Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, let me just read to you some of the things which are written about Antiochus Epiphanes in Daniel 11. It says, the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods. And you have a prophecy in Revelation chapter 13 that the beast will do that. It says the beast will blaspheme those who are living in heaven. Again, showing perhaps a parallelism. This scripture in Daniel 11, 36 goes on to say, and he shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. Now, what wrath? It could refer to the wrath of God. It could also refer to the wrath of the Babylonian system, because there are several scriptures talking about the fact that the Babylonian system is a very wrathful system, a system which did for many, many hundreds of years persecute martyrs, killed martyrs, those who stood up for Jesus Christ. Think of the bloody Spanish Inquisition, just for one example. And historians are trying to tell you today that never took place either. So either wrath could be referred to here, but in any event, it would be completed when God intervenes, or it would be completed when Babylon will be destroyed. In either case, it could be a reference here to the last leader of the revived, quote-unquote, holy Roman Empire. It goes on to say in this passage, he shall regard neither the god, or better, gods, of his fathers, nor the desire of women. Now, that's an interesting statement here. Looking at some commentaries to see what they have to say about the desire of women, it could either mean, and this is what Antiochus Epiphanes actually did, he lived with a lot of women, but he never married one. He lived in very licentious relationships. And so when it says he will not regard the desire of women, and women obviously would like to be married in a lawful marriage, it could be referring to that concept. In other words, he was disregarding what women may want. But you could also look at it from that standpoint. If he doesn't desire women, or doesn't have the desire of women, maybe it's a reference to his sexual preferences. We find out more and more about leaders who are openly practicing homosexuals and proud of it. So again, something to perhaps think about. This passage goes on to say, he will also not regard any god, for he shall exalt himself above them all. But in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses, and a god which his fathers did not know he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Now again, some have suggested that this could refer to the beast's unnatural relationship to the false prophets, and referring to the false prophet as a god which his fathers didn't know and which he will honor. It's a possibility because the false prophet, it says, will deceive the people through his false signs and miracles, and even being able to bring down fire from heaven. And it says in 2 Thessalonians that he is doing those powers and fulfilling those powers by the hand of Satan, the devil himself. I'd like to conclude by saying that the prophecies are clear, that Europe will unite. We are seeing the final revival of the ancient Roman Empire happening in Europe right now. It will ultimately revive in such a fashion that there are going to be 10 nations or groups of nations, the 10 kings, the 10 horns of the beast on which the woman sits in Revelation 17. They will give their power and their authority to the beast, to that charismatic political leader who perhaps got into that position through intrigue and flattery. And when that happens, they will militarily intervene in the Middle East to attempt to bring peace to that region. Perhaps after Israel has received a mortal wound or a decisive defeat in a coming war, which Hosea chapter 5 and verse 13 talks about, that Judah will see its wound, and then they will try to get help from the king of Assyria and won't find it there. When that happens, the United States of America and Great Britain won't have any more role to play. They will by that time be in captivity. Again, some people say that can never happen because America is still so powerful. Who would dare to attack America? Well, have you seen in the last several years how quickly America went down militarily, politically, economically, insofar as its influence is concerned in the world? They're already fighting wars in Afghanistan, which are ongoing, which, according to some analysis, cannot be won. They're trying to get their troops out of Iraq, and this causes all kinds of problems. Just imagine there is some more war going on in the future with North Korea. Just imagine something should happen in Iraq. How much more can America do militarily with the debt they are in? When all those foreign creditors will say, enough is enough, we're not going to extend the line of credit any longer to you. It's not that difficult to perceive that that can happen anytime soon, especially as we have heard when a Great Depression is still a possibility, a strong possibility, and that will specifically refer to the United States of America more so than perhaps any other country. The Bible is clear it's going to happen. Now, you and I may speculate a little bit as to how, but we know it's going to happen. And we are living in the United States of America, and we are seeing daily, those of us who are watching what is going on, how it is developing. Europe is destined to become the most powerful force in the world. But this is not good news. It's not good news for Germany. It's not good news for Europe. It's not good news for the United States. It's not good news for the entire world. Because, as I said earlier, they will be responsible, largely, to bring about the Great Tribulation, which is a time of war against mainly the modern descendants of ancient Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh, the United States of America and Great Britain, and also, of course, against the house of Judah, the Jews, and also against those in the Church of God who are not as close to God as they should be. So let's keep watching, and let's not get all excited about wild speculations floating around there, which only are meant to detract you from what is really prophesied in the Bible.